777 Radio Podcast. This is my first episode, so as we get going, should get better and better. I'm learning the audio tools, which I just don't use audio that much. But right out of the gate here, I want to do a shout out to a supporter who runs beambarns.com. That's BEAMBARNS.com. He's your source for custom designed timber frame barns on any occasion. Give him a call if you're interested in barns. Go look at his website. He's a big supporter and has made the podcast possible in certain ways. And if you do make contact, tell him Crow sent you. Anyhow, this episode that I'm coming out of the gate here with, I talked with CD Channel. That's C-E-E-D-E-E. And Chris over at CD Channel is stepping up, and maybe he's the third generation away from Bill Bryson, who got me started by watching his channel. Chris is now producing video at a very high level. The quality is every bit as good as mine, and he's streaming live, so he's actually making available his 8-inch telescope for real-time live views of the moon for people who just, you know, can't do it on their own or live in a place where they can or can't afford it, whatever the case may be. We talk about, when we come out of the gate, we talk about equipment, the best brands of scope, how we're doing this, how you can do it. We talk about death. We talk about the lunar wave. We talk about NASA and the fraud that NASA has been committing. We talk about false flags. We talk about just about everything under the sun, even the flat earth and the electric universe. And one of the cool things about this episode is Chris and I don't see eye to eye on a number of these topics, but I think it's important to point out just because we don't see eye to eye, there's no reason that we can't find common ground, understand that we're working towards a common goal, and work together. So here it comes, man. Episode 1 of Crow 777 Radio. Here we go. All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. I have Chris D with me tonight, who runs a YouTube channel called CD, which is spelled C-E-E-D-E-E. And you will know you're on his channel when you notice that the header has full moons all the way across it. And with that, welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks, Crow 777, man. I appreciate you having me on. And yeah, that was the correct thing. You can also search Moon TV Live or Take Back Space, all one word on YouTube, and it should pull it up.
Cool, cool. We're going to do that again at the end just to make sure people can find you. Yeah, I noticed on your About page that you have quite a few links going on there. So actually, I know we've got some things that we'd written down that we want to cover, but let's just quickly let people know what you've been doing. You basically run a YouTube channel and you've been filming the moon. And so before I jump into some of the things that we know we want to cover, I noticed that you caught a hell of a transit of a black object across the moon last night. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, hell yeah, man. So yesterday I was doing some work. Like I told you, I wanted to have a chat with you, but I had to do all my work. So I set up the scope outside and I just had it recording, right? As soon as I hit record on it, I was trying to do the same type of time period that I think we caught the pulses at, right? So around 6 p.m. Eastern to 8 p.m. Eastern. Wide shot, had a really dead center focus, and I was really paying attention. And this transit went across. It was like about 2.5 seconds in real time. And it was very clear, and I was very excited about it. But I kept filming, you know, like just to try and keep more footage going. And yesterday was a very active night, to be honest, man. It was one of the most active nights I've ever seen in terms of satellites, in terms of, like, there were lots of birds passing by. There were things in front of the moon, clearly. So, yeah, the transit was very interesting. The video's up. I've been trying to get them up a little bit more quickly than usual because I tend to back up a lot of my work and then I end up not getting to it. So I wanted to get that up. It's the same thing with the pulses as well. I want to just get that out first so people can look at it and then I can do more research on it.
Yeah, it's very cool. You know, right before I got ready to do this, I was over on your channel and I noticed it almost appears like it's triangular. It's kind of tough to tell. But what I have been trying to do when I get transits like this is sometimes I grab the focus knob real quick. I mean, on these ones that go across in a second or two, you don't have much time. Right. But on the ones that are longer, I try to grab the focus knob and see if I can gain focus by pulling it in a little closer, a little further away. It's just a difficult thing to do.
That's a great idea, yeah.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, you really need a transit that's going to be like more than 5 or 6 seconds. And, you know, if you keep at it, I think I have maybe 3 or 4 that are close to a minute transiting. But anyhow, let's jump in. We've got about 30 items or more that we kind of outlined here that we really wanted to get out to the people. So let's start off by talking about your equipment. So many people, I mean, hundreds, literally, maybe even over 1,000 at this point, have come to my channel saying, I really want to do this. I want to get a scope. So let's just take a minute to talk about your equipment.
Yeah, definitely. So I started, and we talked about this before, but it was a big ramp up towards like buying a lot of gear and then testing out which worked and which didn't. And so I kind of got into it a little bit blind. I had had a couple of scopes in the past, some small ones, 2-inch scopes, 2.5-inch scopes, 4-inch scopes, and a couple of binoculars, right? And so I got into it. I bought my first 80-20 binoculars from Celestron, the big badass ones. And I thought, oh, I could hook these up to a cool tripod, put a little webcam, and I can get, you know, a $300 rig going for the moon. And I was, you know, it was great to look at with my own eyes, but you can't really do any type of real work like that. So my equipment now, what I went in and I threw down $1,100 for the Celestron Nexstar 8-inch SE, which is, I think, one of the best kind of slightly above, you know, I want to say mid-range. Would you call it a mid-range? I mean, it's a lower end price. I mean, they do go up to 20,000, 50,000 scopes. So that's the high end of it. But 1,100 is a lot for some people.
Right.
So I got the Celestron 8-inch, and then I got a Sony mirrorless Alpha 6000 camera, which ran me about 700, 800 with the lenses. But now just for the body for the Alpha 6000 is about 498 on Amazon, which is an incredible deal for the quality that it does. I'll quickly go through a couple of limitations on the camera. It does overheat. You do need good memory cards. You need to think about the accessories before you buy a camera, because there is a definite like $100 to $200, possibly $300 investment post buying just the camera to rig it to the scope and to get it running like you want it.
With batteries and cards, you mean?
Yeah, batteries, cards, the T-ring adapter that we spoke about. So like to get the camera. So I'll explain that. So the camera, you get rid of the lens, right? So I encourage people to try and get an interchangeable lens camera as much as possible, you know, because you can get a point and shoot. But the thing to be aware of there is that you can't take off that lens. So that's a big deal. Like, you can get a great zoomed in shot, but you won't be able to directly hook it up to the scope. So what I do is I hook up the Sony Alpha with the T-ring adapter and then the little T-ring mount, which is a 1.25-inch steel mount that goes directly, and it looks like an eyepiece connector. I started putting that using the diagonal on different eyepieces, but then I realized just putting it direct to scope is probably the best shot you can get. Okay. The least amount of glass in between the camera sensor and the telescope. So that's what I'm running as the base gear setup, the Sony Alpha and the Celestron 8-inch with the little adapter connector. And then I can talk about all the other stuff that goes into streaming and recording, but that's the basic setup.
So to make it perfectly clear for folks, if you want to record at the level that you see Crow 777 or CD or within that ballpark, you really want to try to get an 8-inch scope or better. The truth is, a 4-inch scope or better works beautifully for the moon. Even a 3-inch telescope will give you beautiful views of the moon. What Chris just said is we're basically taking a camera, a DSLR or others, where you can remove the lens and basically the telescope becomes the lens of that camera. You need an adapter, whether you have a Nikon or a Canon or a Sony. There's an adapter ring that goes to that kind of camera. You put it to a T-ring. That goes directly to the scope with no diagonal, no eyepiece, nothing. Camera to scope. And so, Chris, do you think we can agree that with what we've kind of outlined that the price point would be $2,000 or less?
Yeah, $2,000 or less for what, honestly, I'm using. And I think if you just asked me directly, I could tell you all the different pieces and it would stay under something like $2,000. I've spent upwards of $4,000 to $5,000 on all the extra stuff that I kind of don't use about half of it now. I know it would be fun to sit and like play with all the filters, but it's not as useful as what we're actually doing, which is filming raw. Like I said, just the scope between you and the moon. And that's, you know, I feel like in my gut that that's the best way to film, even though, like, I think filters, like when you get the more advanced filters, that would be, you know, the place to start adding stuff.
Okay. So the other thing I think it's important for us to touch on is people have seen my footage where I started on an 8-inch robotic mead Schmidt cast grain. By the way, I wanted to cover that.
Do it, yeah.
I think we both agree that Schmidt cast grain is really kind of like the work scope for doing what we're doing.
Definitely a workhorse and great build. And whatever anybody thinks about the accessories that come with the Celestron stuff, the actual scope itself is top notch, I believe. But it's limited experience, of course.
That's right. And there are, refractors, reflectors, Newtonian. There's all these things you can use, but a Schmidt cast grain or SCT style scope is compact and it is kind of built for doing what we're describing here. But let's be clear here. A lot of people have seen my footage of a mead. I will no longer support mead. I bought a 12 inch, I don't know, a year and a half ago, and it failed left and right. Come to find out, they're made in Tijuana and they're no longer the American kind of tank that they once were. So, Chris, can we agree that we would steer people to Celestron, that is really the main game in town?
I would tell you from my experience with Celestron that it's served me very well, and I have to just take your word on the mead because of somebody, like I always trust people who've used the equipment. I haven't used enough mead scopes. I've used one of the smaller ones and one at an observatory, but not enough to say what you're saying. But I believe you if you threw down on a 12-inch and it sucked. So I would definitely recommend Celestron.
Right, and I don't want to bag mead for life because the functionality and the optics, there were things there that were just mind-boggling, but they need to get their quality back. And now that they're not built in the U.S., as so many things are not, they're either built in China, in this case, Tijuana, Mexico, it's a far cry from the thing that I bought in the 90s, which still works as good as the day I bought it. So anyhow, let's keep moving on here because I
Here,
just.
let me throw in something there
Cool.
while we're at it, because Mead does good lenses though, because I
Right.
do have a couple of great eyepieces from Mead that are just insanely beautiful. So I would say think about Mead in terms of eyepieces in a different way, depending, because some of them you can get the older ones that are still made well. And the other thing is eyepieces. Just two more brands to note, be aware of are Televue, TELEVUE,
Yep.
I think is an incredibly good brand, and Baader, BAADER. That's one of my prime lenses, which is the Baader Planetarium Click Stop. I threw down, I think it's like $300 for it, but it's a beast, like encased hard steel black. And you can do from, I guess, 8 millimeters to 24 millimeter click stop
Yep.
while without disconnecting it. It's fantastic. So and it actually has a direct to T-ring adapter, so I can put basically the Sony right into the Baader Planetarium, right into the scope. Now it's very finicky because that thing is huge, and then the camera makes it. So I have a few weight issues, Crow,
Yeah.
but basically when I zoom in on the 8 millimeter with that is just it's insane. And so what happens though, just one quick, I'll finish up, is with the eight millimeter and 12 millimeter, you'll start noticing a lot of the dirt on the front of the scope, a lot more than any other lenses, if you start working with the scope. And so I'm really excited for a new scope that's very clean to try that Baader, because it's going to look awesome, I know.
Okay, so just to be clear for everyone, Baader has a reputation for really good optics, and when you're using an eyepiece, you're generally not using a camera. That's when you're just using the tool optically, and I think both Chris and I can verify, do not ever buy a cheap eyepiece. It just isn't
Right.
worth it. If you're going to get an eyepiece, get quality. There's no middle of the road there.
They always bundle them, but I would definitely recommend against that, having bought
Yes.
two bundles. They're useless, pretty
That,
much.
that's right. And even the stuff when you buy a new telescope, it comes with like a 26 mil eyepiece. And
Yeah.
sometimes those aren't even glass. Those could be optical grade plastic made in China. And I'm not even kidding.
No
So,
joke. No
yeah,
joke.
so there it is. So also, let's talk a minute about video quality, because when I started my YouTube channel, I'm almost convinced that one of the things that got me recognized so quickly was just because the video wasn't the same old fuzzy, there's a UFO that we can kind of make out. So I wanted to talk to you about the quality. What did you have to do to get the quality? And did you have examples? Did you, I mean, how did you realize the quality was so important? And then how did you actually implement it? Because let's face it, right now you're a player. You're producing video every bit as good as what I do, and maybe even in some cases better.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. You were definitely, I kept talking to my friends after we spoke the first time about how you watched Bill Bryson, and we
Yep.
can kind of pull in that question to that comment too. So yeah, I started watching kind of go back a little bit. I've been into the ufology stuff and conspiracy truth seeker stuff for a very, very long time. I've been in graphic design for a very long time for I'm talking about since 98. I'm 35, but I started when I was a teenager. So I've watched the progression of space and graphics, and I've seen all that, and I was like, man, NASA's getting these amazing shots. I mean, I bet if I got a scope, I could see Saturn way up close, right? And nebula, you probably have a similar story.
Yep.
So I got into that a little bit. I got rudimentary stuff, like I said, a smaller scope, the binoculars, a webcam. And then when I after I saw Bill Bryson's stuff, I actually hadn't seen your stuff yet. I'd seen, I think DSW. I'd seen a clip maybe. I'd heard about the lunar wave, but I hadn't really stumbled upon it yet. I was still more in the NASA zone. I was like, oh, who's just filming the moon? I wasn't really into the conspiracy side of it yet. And so when I watched Bill's stuff, I was like, man, that is incredibly good. Like, that just blew my mind. I was staggered as to how he did it from home. And he was sitting there having fun and talking to people. He's like, we're on the moon, guys. I was like, cool. So when I saw that, and then right after that, about a few weeks later, I found your channel, and I was blown away. I sat there just like in awe, because I was like, man, I guess it can be done on a budget. And I didn't think you hadn't dropped a lot of money on it, but I figured, I'm not rich by any means, but I make my own money, so I can spend it on whatever I want. And so I figured, let me throw all my savings at this scope, and that's really where I got up to. So when I got the 8-inch and I started looking at the eyepieces, first of all, we talked about this before as well, but oh my God, when you first get your first scope, it's like a first date scenario. Amazing, super exciting. And of course, some things are going to be a lot more disappointing than you think, like stars and planets. And then the moon is going to blow your mind apart, like you've never thought before. It's going to change your life, I believe. If you're anywhere, if you have that kind of childlike excitement. What do you think, Crow? Did it do that for you?
I think you're nailing. I mean, when you first, even with a good pair of binoculars, when you first look up at the moon or the Milky Way, you get hooked. I mean, if you're kind of the kind of person who's going to take an interest in this, you're going to be hooked. But there is no doubt when you use an eyepiece and not a camera, there is a view you will get when you first glance at the moon that is mind-blowing. And I think you covered that when you look at all the Hubble nonsense, and you go out to look at your first nebula, which is usually M42, the Orion Nebula. It's quite a letdown. But anyhow, back over to you.
So I saw Bill's stuff, and I was like, man, he's doing a webcam. But then as I studied it more, he had a friend of his do a custom cage for it so he could rest it properly. And then you realize, you start playing with this thing, you start putting the camera near the eyepiece, and you're like, man, I can't get this quality from end to end of the sensor. So anyway, long story short, I finally got the T-ring, like I said. I put the thing on the Celestron. And I started, but there is a level you can see. If you jump back to some of the earlier Moon TV videos or even Moon clips that I started to do, you really do have to do, I don't know, 50, 100 hours of photography work to understand lighting, to understand shutter. It isn't that simple, even though it is, simplex, I would say. I kind of steal this from Angry Photographer a lot, but it's a great point. It's a simplex function once you got it. But getting there is quite complicated. So, and now it's like really muscle memory. Like, I can sit there and I can scope, and I can do the camera with one hand while I talk to people. It's become a very easy type of seamless task, but getting there was very complicated, because you have to pay attention. And I'll be more specific about that, for an example. So ISO, if anyone's familiar, is a little knob on your camera, or a dial or a touch, that allows more or less light to come into your sensor. That's the really layman's understanding of it. But in terms of the moon and planets and stars, this means a lot. It's one of the most important things, shutter and ISO and the management of that, in order to keep basically the details of the surface of the moon are not visible perfectly evenly, unless you have the perfect balance of shutter and ISO. Am I right? And
Yeah, I mean,
f-stop, of course, but you can't run f-stop on a scope, so.
yeah, there's no doubt. And actually, to be clear, the scope does have an f-stop, but everything you're doing with the camera is generally what ends up counting.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can't adjust the f-stop from the camera like you could with a special lens that's made for the camera, for example. But yes, f-stop is basically the depth of field, and you're going to get that with because the scope, like you said, becomes the lens of the camera.
So
Right, go ahead.
I kind of feel like, we've done this whole kind of opening segment to help people understand how we're doing it and how they could do it.
Oh, I know. Let me finish up, man. Now I know where the thought was. It was the quality. You asked me about the quality of the
Right.
shot, right? So I saw Bill, I saw your stuff. I'm like, man, I need to match that if I'm going to get anywhere, because really that's what's visceral about it, right? You get a visual clip, you get some cool little audio piece, and not too much, not too much fluff. And then people watch it and they're like, damn, that's it. And then there are hundreds of clips about weird things that I used to watch, and I'm like, man, this is grainy. This is terrible. Like you said, when they showed, oh, we crashed a satellite into the moon. Here's the footage. And I'm like, man, like my footage is way better, and I don't even know what I'm doing, and I can get a better shot of this exact spot. I can't see anything. So there are many things like that. So what I did, now what I'm pushing is basically 1080p solid, right?
Yep.
At 60 frames per second from my home. So my connection's like just a pushed out, maxed out cable connection, and I can upload up to 10.8 megs per second. So what I push is 8 megs per second out. So I have about 2 meg buffer to talk to people and to watch the stream myself. But that I'm pushing as much quality out of that camera using an HDMI cable with gold-plated whatever into a computer that's directly only the stream. And so really, guys, I mean, that's where it's at, because there's a lot of crappy footage where people haven't gotten to has been able to really be ruthless about their editing. Ruthless, and I mean with themselves, about their ego and about the quality of the footage. And that's what I appreciate about your work, man. Like, there isn't a clip out there that you've put out that isn't like, damn. Damn, bro. It's like so impressive. So, I mean, honestly, and I feel very blessed this past couple of months, and of course for the Venus transit that I got. Really, I want to say I'm doing a good job, but I'm also lucky because I have the time. Because really, a lot of it is about the time and the patience and watching and paying attention, and being there. So, what do you think about that? About
I mean, I think what you just said sums it up. So many people, well, not as much as it used to happen, come to my channel and say, this is faked. I've used a telescope a lot and I've never filmed anything like this. And you just nailed it on the head. It takes time. If you're going to film with the intent of doing what you see CD channel doing or Crow 777 channel, you're going to need to put in some hours. But you've got to love it and you've got to have an interest in it. And to kind of sum that up, you're not going to get a DSLR with one battery to do this. You're going to get a DSLR with three or four unless you're using an AC pack. But you started to touch on something that you do that I don't do simply because I'm a one-man show and I don't have enough time. When I film, I'm looking at everything as it happens. And so I want to talk about your stream. You are streaming live video, which in essence allows anyone that may not be able to afford a telescope or live in a place where they couldn't even use one. It allows anyone to log on to your channel when you're live and have free access to an 8-inch telescope viewing in real time. So can you talk a minute about that?
Can you just repeat that question so we can keep the flow going?
Right.
Yeah.
So you offer a service that I do not. I'm a one-man show, and I just don't have the ability to do it by myself or the time for that matter. You offer live streaming. And what live streaming basically is it allows anyone to come to your channel when you're streaming live and have free access to an 8-inch telescope filming the sky above us, the moon, whatever you're on. It gives them access to that. Can you just address that really quickly?
Yeah, Rockin', thanks very much for that.
Yep.
Right. So exactly. So when I first started, I had a few missions in mind. One was, of course, the quality, like I said. Two was really to kind of, in a way, help you. I know randomly I was like, man, can I do a little part in this and kind of help corroborate some things that are out there without like overextending myself? And as soon as I got in, of course, I was like 100% committed. But I was like, that was one of my first goals. And the second one was like, man, I wish NASA had a scope of the moon that I could just log into a website, punch in some coordinates, and be like, you know, and track that. Why don't they have like four scopes, like, but even budget scopes? Like, what would it be for NASA? Like,
Yeah,
two
really.
grand each. 2 grand each with a computer. Like, it would be my rig, like $2,500 times five with two people. It would be a very minimal expenditure to give people like what I end up now giving them. But what I thought was like, man, can I do this? Is that even possible to do while I do my work and my music at the same time? Because I figured that's the only way, like you said. And in a way while my friend KC does help me, you know, it is really just me, but I have this kind of, you know, when I moved from New York, I consolidated all my stuff. I don't know how, if people have lived in big cities before, but you get a pod where you store all your stuff. You have another place where you store your stuff. You have another sister's house where you put your things. You have an office. And so when I came down to Florida, I brought all my computers and all my gear. So I'm in one little apartment with these five computer screens. So when I'm streaming, I'm not only watching it on four or five different monitors, but it's being recorded in three different ways. And I'm getting this music from a different computer. So it's a real, almost like I wanted to do like a mini TV station. And then of course the custom view of the moon, as much as I can, I try and placate and, you know, not placate, but, honor people's requests of like custom shots if they'd like me to pan to a certain place or explain a certain part of the moon as much as I can, as long as I have like the energy to do it. I'm going to go in and try and give them that information. And while it's exhausting, it's extremely fulfilling and gratifying because all of a sudden now I'm a player, not in just in the web community, but more of like I wanted to be a scientist, but I didn't want to go and like have to get a degree and do 4 years of astrophysics and 4 years of blah, and then get a master's, and then go to an observatory, and then go through the ringer, and then get stuck on one project with one stream of data. You know,
yeah.
This way, I'm completely free, and in a way, you've done the same. Like you can basically sidestep big agencies and say, you know what, I don't care about your principles and ethics. I have my own. And here's the tech to match it. And here's the quality of footage to match it. So that's where I'm trying to position myself. And I'm still, man, I'm still a baby newbie right here. I'm just like, I've just been in the graphic design field. So I'm applying professional design skills to a field that I'm still very new at. But the tech is there. And I've always been a good tech person. So I'm just pushing the tech as like, I've always been like, I downloaded the beta version of everything. I download the first camera. I'm a day one adopter of things. I've always been like, I bought 3D printers day one, and I'm going off on a rant, but that's the kind of mentality. You have to be hungry for the next step. And that's part of the conspiracy thing for me is like, I want the tech. I don't want, you know, like I kind of don't think politics, they can't fire Congress entirely, you know, but they could possibly give us better technology. For people who deserve it, or people who know how to
you
use
think,
it,
yeah,
right. At
yeah.
least, you know, be like, oh man, there are like 100 YouTube astronomers. Man, let's bring them into the fold. Let's see if they have something to say. And they completely push us out and ignore us, and it's and make. I mean, Brian, I got to tell you a story about Brian Cox, but I want you to talk a little. So please go ahead.
Well, I mean, all to sum up what you're just saying, I say quite a bit. At what point does NASA have to provide lunar footage that even approaches what Bill Bryson, what you are producing? I mean, it's ridiculous. And I know we talked earlier about my stories of people in observatories that had worked there or currently were, three of them, saying that they weren't allowed to point those big scopes at the moon unless they were given coordinates. I told you a story about going up to the big 27-inch scope in Flagstaff that found Pluto, supposedly. And they let us view one crater. There were 15 people in line. We'd all gone through. And we're, okay, what else can we see on the moon? And they're like, nope, this is what we're looking at tonight. And it's like this thing, restricted access. And so your live stream and people making videos are kind of breaking that restricted access to the moon. And you want to know something? I think that's a big part of why we're kind of finding these things that nobody ever knew about. But to kind of tag on to where you were going with your live stream, I understand you're building a network of observers kind of around the world, or maybe it's not so formally organized, but can you talk about that? I think you're muted out again, bro.
Word up. Great. Thanks. So the network of people is just people who have actually gone on the stream and who have started to ping me, and possibly some people have gotten inspired, same way I got inspired by you and Bill. And of course, you're still doing the work. Houston is doing the work. Is Randy Houston? I need to make sure I'm not mixing them up.
No, Houston Skywatch was the individual that I stopped. He had been filming. He hasn't filmed in a while. I know he still has an interest in this, but Randy has caught the lunar wave. And Richard,
right, Randy.
Yeah.
And Richard. Yeah. Yep. Richard 205 Maria, of course. But the other slew of guys is Z Proxy, who's in Estonia, and he films the moon almost every night if he can. So we have a corroborating shot from Eastern Europe, which is awesome.
That is awesome.
We have this girl, Ravenlox, who is very active on the community but doesn't film as much. But we're trying to encourage her because she's in Guam, which would be an amazing shot to have.
Right.
Even once a week would be great. Poignantly enough and it's Providence that it happened yesterday. Z Proxy has a shot, and I think Cosmic Surfer got a shot from South Africa of the moon at the same time as I was filming. So I think we have a triangulated shot last night. I have to check it today, but I believe that we might have that, which is insane. I mean, that's the type of stuff that we really need to move towards, is having multiple people.
Please.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's right. Sorry.
Yeah. No problem. And then the second step to that, I thought, was, you know, use some design skills coupled with potentially reaching out to some independent developers, you know, guys who know how to do JavaScript and like frameworks with the not necessarily deep code, but like even basic framework stuff, and build a map where we can almost like a Ustream map where you can click in and see people streaming or see old videos of them in different locations around the world. And if we can eventually get enough people on board, like 10, 20 people, man, like NASA, ESA, these people can't stop us because they have budget restrictions. They have, higher ups. They have a party line that they have to toe. There are political implications. 20 independent astronomers filming the sky all the time is going to just steamroll out this whole narrative of the illusion that we have of Disney space.
Right.
Right? Like, Disney space is what we want to get rid of.
That's right. Well,
and if we want to kind of segue this into a little bit of the more, you know, philosophical and metaphysical side, like, we've talked a little bit, but I was very conspiratorial for a long time, and then I was less conspiratorial, and then I gave it up, and then I became more conspiratorial. I've checked out a lot of the different theories: flat earth, concave, Ptolemaic geocentric, heliocentric. I have my doubts about a lot of different parts of it, but having looked now through the scope for quite a while, and I'm going to for a lot, I hope for the rest of my life, you know. But I think 2-3 years in, I'll have a much better idea about reality. And in that case, what's happening is I'm starting to see these objects in a different way. I'm no longer belief is the enemy of knowing.
Right.
Is a great line, because, you know, it's not like the umbrella, but of course it is true to a lot of points. Like, if you don't go and do the research on it and look at the math and really just accept that people are using math to do things, but they might be explaining things in a false way. Do you know what I mean? Like, there might be a midway point where you can kind of say, wow, you guys are freaking liars. But, you know, like, not every single person that works at NASA's offices, they could be sisters and brothers and kids and relatives of people we know who are not people out there to kill us, you know, or rob us. You know, I don't want to think that everybody's an evil bastard or person. So I started to pull back a little bit and no longer have these very stringent hypotheses about the moon or space, but I'm trying to be a little more measured in my approach about that.
That's a good thing, because early on my channel, the fact that I was not shouting alien or, on some of the objects, I think a lot of people appreciated that, because there were so many channels that would film an out-of-focus seagull and assure everyone it was the reptilians coming to suck our blood or something.
Nibiru, man, you know.
Yeah, the planet that's always on the way but never gets here.
Never gets here. Same like Mars. We never get anything from there.
Crazy. Well, Matt Damon will get us there. Mm-hmm. But I think now that we've dipped our toe in the conspiracy realm, it's a good time for me to address the lunar wave.
Yep.
Because over the past week or so, it's possible that you may have filmed it twice independently on two different nights. So let's talk a minute about the lunar wave, and I'll kind of bunch two things together here. Just give me your impressions of what you are considering about the lunar wave, and do you think the moon is described correctly to us? Is it a rock in space? So there's two things there. Address the lunar wave. You've now possibly filmed it twice. Needs to be vetted still. But do you on top of that, do you think the moon has been described correctly to us?
All right, let me go. I'll do it backwards. So the moon definitely is missing a lot of data. We're missing visual data. We're missing corroborative evidence that they've landed there. Those films clearly look put together. The footage of the moon libration and evidence that they tell us about where the moon is clearly does match up in a mathematical way. So there is a side to what NASA says about the moon and space that I do just believe based on my physical reaction to what the material is, right? So I just can't get away from that being realistic. But then on the flip, clearly the pictures where they're like, oh, we have this space orb, spacecraft that's right next to Pluto. I'm like, I don't think so. So things like that, my gut is instinctual to say, like, I think you can film that from Earth and make it look like you're there. I've always thought that. So I think they could have done it 50 years ago. I think the technology now, like with their scopes, if I have an 8-inch scope and I can film what people are just like, and you're filming on an 11-inch, it blows people's minds. On a 20, 30, 40-inch scope, you're like
I
in a
know.
whole other game. And if people understand optics, you'll realize that the scope, as you go up in inches, it goes up by exponential components of light gathering, right? So when you go from 8 to 9 1/4, you're talking about like 23% light increase. Go up to 11, you're talking about 30 to 40% light increase. You move up to 20, 30, forget it, dude. I don't even know what that might look like,
Hundreds of percent,
just forget it. So that type of stuff, I think, so to go to the lunar wave now, especially last night with all the weird stuff. And last night, man, I caught Hubble for the first time. I know I'm telling you all this crazy stuff, but this week has been just radical for me. So yesterday I caught Hubble not only on a wide camera shot, but the telescope close up too, where I tracked it manually, and it matched up with what Stellarium said. Now, did it look like what they say Hubble is? I can't tell yet. I also have to vet that, zoom in. I don't think I'm going to be able to get any detail. It just looks like a light. But anyway, so the lunar wave, I had my doubts about filming it. I didn't have doubts about you having filmed it or Richard, that being real or not. I didn't doubt the footage, but I had no idea if it was something that could really be filmed like that. I thought it was like this once in a, 2, 3 year occurrence that you could really capture it. But now having think, I think that it's that first one is pretty rockin'. That second one, I don't know, but it does match up in terms of the kind of there's the first wave that comes through with a little tail of it, and then there's a tiny pause, and then there's another strong one with another tail. And I looked at your footage again today right before our call, and I'm looking at it, and it looks, I mean, clearly your footage is really awesome because it does that kind of push of the lunar surface, the regolith that moves it down while it goes. But and the one that I have is very like digital, like a scan line. But it does match up in terms of the strong wave with the weak one right after it, and then another strong wave with the weak one right after it. The double pulse with the, and so there's a consistent, and I think patterns have always helped me discover things better and research things better. So what I'm trying to look at is what direction are they coming in? Can we determine the speed of them? I think they're a real occurrence now. So having come full circle and having looked at it and looked at your stuff and now really having thought about it for a few days, I'm like, man, maybe it is something that is just has been technologically prohibitive. Now that we have 60 frames per second, 1080p all the time, maybe it's something that is constantly happening. Or a little bit more frequently than we have thought. Now, I read about your, I heard about you talk about the vernal equinox and things happening more around the equinox, right? And it's March 20th, right? Would be the spring equinox, I think.
Yeah, I've checked this year, but yeah, right there within a day or two.
Right. So we are approaching that kind of period. So it does, there are theories out there that you have proposed that I think are relevant. Some people in my chat have suggested Birkeland currents or maybe something that's happening in the ionosphere or at the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers above the Earth. And maybe that's something that's happening across the whole sky. But just because the moon is this huge object that we can see so clearly, we see it more visibly when it crosses in front of the moon. Maybe it's covering the whole sky crow. You know, it's possible. The other thing is that it could be isolated to the moon, and it's it's doing that refresh rate thing. But at the same time, the moon could be an electrical object. I believe that the craters now, I'm almost convinced that they're electric scarification and not meteorites. That's one thing that has been misrepresented, I believe. Like the idea that space is very dangerous and there are all these things flying around, I think is one of the big lies. Because there's no proof of that.
I agree with you on that. I think that's true. Yeah,
that's one of the big ones for me. So I don't think the moon's been bombarded, like they said, right? And I think tidal locking can be explained differently as well. But I do believe that the moon has an electromagnetic connection to Earth. I believe that it affects the clouds, depending on how where it is in the ecliptic. I believe it affects the clouds depending on its phase and how much light is coming through. And I think the light is part of an electromagnetic flux wave. And so whatever the lunar wave pulse effect is, anomaly is, or maybe not anomaly, I think is part of an electromagnetic flux pattern that we're finally noticing, or maybe is being done manually. I don't know that. I can't say that for sure. But you're right. Like there's a lot to be research vetted. There's a lot more to be vetted.
Yeah, I mean, indeed. And just to add to the conversation, I do have two clips. And the first 2012 catch of the lunar wave, which was done at the fall equinox, a video engineer sometime later went at it and said he could demonstrate that there was enough ambient light in that clip and one other to demonstrate that the wave was not going beyond the moon. I know there's another channel who has tried to say the opposite of that, but it sounds to me like you're currently at a place where you feel it's a solid object.
I feel that the moon is a solid object, yes. I mean, unless there's some sort of way to do a projection that does what the moon does physically, that in that case, it's this whole other realm of understanding that I don't have language or math for. So all I can look at it in terms of my primitive understanding of physical reality is that it looks like a real object, having looked at it for now, what's over 1,000 hours of footage, and really analyzed it over and over again. If it is transparent and it's like this projection hologram that's cut like Hadibov says with the smaller moon behind it, yeah, and Aristarchus is like the black box, man, if it's that, holy crap. Like basically it's holy crap in my mind because I don't have I don't have a reality to really explain that. But in the reality that I see in front of me, it seems and acts like a very, very special physical object in our reality. That's the only way I can. I'm really trying for the words here, but I just think about it in a visual way. So
I wanted to add something. So you did mention that I, from the outset, as soon as I had realized that the 2012 capture was a filmed event, and I began to piece together my early assumptions on what was going on, as fate would have it, I had been pushing that people learn what equinoxes and solstices were for the months running up to that accidental capture. Now, out of the gate, well, not out of the gate, but pretty close in, I was trying to associate the lunar wave with the equinoxes. And as you know, I've made two predictions near equinoxes. And to be fair, if you vet the two captures you have in this past week and they are vetted out as probable lunar waves, we are now closer to the vernal or spring equinox than we are to the winter solstice. But you also have the only two captures, again, if they are vetted and determined to be probable lunar waves, that happened in the wintertime. But what I find interesting is your captures are very quick and very transparent. And if there's something going on with respect to where the sun is, and in the old globe model and the old astrotheology that relies on the globe model, the sun is not yet over the equinox. And I still use this language, not accepting the NASA kind of solar system model, for the simple reason that we know damn well that all of a sudden what's called Passover in religions, what's called the vernal equinox, when the sun is supposedly coming across an equator based on the globe model, it gets stronger. Now, if we think about this in relationship to your capture, these are almost like weaker waves because the sun, and since I don't have a better way to describe it, is not above the equator or strengthened as it will be as we pass the vernal equinox. But I just thought I'd throw that out there.
No, that's a great point. You've done more research on that than I have, but I am fascinated by that aspect of it.
It's a whole thing, and I really do feel like maybe the equinoxes are gateways of some kind, but like you said, we've got so much more to learn. So I'm going to keep bumping along here. We're about 45 minutes in, and I want to hit these points that we've outlined because I think people would be interested
I
in
know we have
hearing
so much that we always talk about a lot. Yeah.
it. So I'm just going to start burning through them. So
Let's do it.
has observing firsthand radically changed your perceptions of what space, the moon, and the so-called planets are?
Absolutely. I recommend everyone try it. I'm going to kind of answer them quickly. So, yeah, I recommend everyone try it because it will change not only your reality, your perception of reality, but your life in terms of like what's been important and what is just right up there above you, right out there for the taking. A whole field of science, a whole like Indiana Jones style quest that we've all wanted as a kid is just right there for the taking, and it's just no one's doing anything.
That's right. And I think
So
you,
go for it.
yeah, I think you made a great point that it's probable that now that we have the tech and the ability to do what we're doing, that may play a big role in why we're seeing all these things now.
Definitely. More
So,
eyes on it.
yeah, if I was to take it a step further, do you, as I do, consider that the space agencies and other information sources going back into history have intentionally misdescribed our place in the scheme of things and space in general?
I absolutely agree with that. I think I've moved away from the 100% lying down to not a 50-50, but let's say 60-40, depending on the day. But I believe that they have to produce real evidence because there are too many real people working there, and it's too difficult to produce all that stuff. But stuff that is highlighted in the media that makes people shift opinions, I think is definitely misdirected intentionally and hidden, maybe because of an initial error where they decided to go with a theory 100 years ago and they can't go back on the lie. Or it's a catch-22 where they reveal it, then Russia has to reveal it, then China has to reveal it, or it's something that we can never know. But it definitely changes your idea of space. You got to get to know space better than they're telling you because it's been misrepresented.
Agreed, agreed. And I'll tell you what, man, we have to do a show roughly a year from now so that now that you're about a year in, it would be very interesting to see what your perceptions are another year from now. Okay, that's it for the free episode. I hope those of you that are here for the first time will go ahead and subscribe and catch the full episode and be able to comment and catch the video as I begin to post them in the members-only area. We talk about so much more. I ask them if the Earth is misdescribed. We talk about Bill Bryson. We talk some more about the sun, telescopes, about NASA and whether it's committing fraud. We talk about the moon landing. We talk about his thoughts on flat Earth, on aliens, the electric universe. We talk about television, false flags, planets. Everything under the sun comes up before we're done here. And this episode did go a little long. So again, this is my first episode out of the gate, and you have just listened to the free portion. Hope you guys become members and join me on the other side. Cheers.